This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Officials expressed grave concern about and slammed the IOF attack on Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital, which has claimed dozens of more Palestinian lives. Josep Borrell from the EU is saying that Gaza is the biggest open-air graveyard. Fresh from his election win, Russia's President Putin warns of World War III in case of Western military deployment to Ukraine. Hello and welcome live from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the Israeli regime has again hit the Al-Shifa Medical Hospital in Gaza, killing and wounding a number of Palestinians. The Gaza Health Ministry says at least 31,726 Palestinians have been killed since October the 7th. Our correspondent, Moti Abu Musabe, brings us the details.
The Israeli occupation forces conducted a blitz offensive against the Al-Shifa medical complex over the last night, where hundreds of the Israeli tanks and the Israeli forces moved in a swift attack against the compound. Amid the heavy gunfire and continuous bombardments, at least 40 consecutive Israeli airstrikes hit the compound, the buildings, the yards, and even the surrounding areas of the Al-Shifa compound, knowing that thousands of the Palestinian civilians are taking shelter in the hospital, in addition to the paramedics and the medical staff and the Palestinian injuries who actually are located there receiving the needed medical care. The Israeli occupation attack actually left thousands of the Palestinian civilians killed and injuries, in addition to the big fire that blazed in the surgery department in a building inside the compound. When it comes to the central area of Gaza Strip, the situation is still catastrophic, as well as the Israeli occupation forces maintain their strikes and incursions against the central area, particularly Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, whereas over the last night the Israeli warplanes destroyed another residential building, claiming the lives of 9 Palestinian civilians. Most of them were children and women. These airstrikes are continued, and even over the last couple of hours, the Israeli artillery maintained its shelling towards the eastern part of Deir el-Balah city. And when it comes to Khan Yunis city, Al-Mawasi area, which is claimed by the Israeli occupation forces as a safe area, it was under a repetitive Israeli attack.
The Israeli regime's recent attack on the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza has drawn widespread condemnation. Officials and organizations have expressed extreme concern about the impact on the sick and wounded, as well as health hospital staff. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called the attack a new crime committed by the criminal Zionist occupation army that will not make Netanyahu and its Nazi army any image of victory. In another reaction, outgoing Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh has blamed the international community for their failure in condemning Israel and ignoring crimes against humanity being committed in Gaza. The head of WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, also labeled the attacks as deeply concerning, warning that the fighting has endangered health workers, patients, and civilians. Al-Shifa, the largest hospital in Gaza, came under at least 40 attacks on Sunday, killing or wounding dozens of more Palestinians. In our news review program, we've discussed the Israeli regime's most recent attacks on the health and medical infrastructure in Gaza.
Fran Hughes is a journalist, author, and activist joining us from Belfast. We also have Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, joining us from Sydney. Welcome to you both. Fran Hughes, I'll start with you. When it comes to the Israeli aggression, in particular when it comes to the hospitals, there hasn't been really a solid piece of news that came out showing that Israeli objective was met, whatever that was, which at the forefront is trying to extinguish the Hamas fighters in one form or another. Why is it that they're continuing with their targeting of the hospitals, do you think?
I think it's a further attack on the civilian infrastructure in Gaza itself. I think the president of Brazil, Luiz da Silva, probably encapsulated this best when I'm paraphrasing him, when he said basically it's an asymmetrical war. What we have is a well-trained, well-armed, well-equipped army fighting civilians. So that, to me, is the best description of what's happening in Gaza. We saw previous attacks, I believe, on the Al-Shifa hospital. Is that the hospital where they said there were tunnels underneath and that they were trying to release captives? It appears that there is no lie too big and there is no atrocity too small that the Israeli offensive forces are not prepared to carry out on the people of Gaza. So when you couple the attacks on the hospitals, if you remember the six young innocent babies who were left to die in their incubators when another hospital, people were forced to evacuate the sick, the wounded, and even the people undergoing intensive care treatment. We're just seeing a continued attack on the civilian population, like the Flower massacres at the Qadi roundabout, where over 400 people, according to the Gaza Ministry of Health, have been murdered. Simply men going out, fathers, sons, uncles, grandfathers, simply going out to try and get some flour in order to save their families and help them going forward in this genocidal famine that has been weaponized as a form of collective punishment in order to subdue and force the Palestinian people into submissions.
Well, Tim Anderson, you had this U.S. intelligence report that came out days ago, and it mentioned a number of things. One of them was about the Hamas fighters, and it said that the Hamas fighters are going to pose a challenge for Israel for years to come. When you take into account the lack of accomplishment in terms of one of the stated goals of Israel, which is eradicating Hamas, in particular when it comes to the tunnels, for example, they have failed there. What does that tell the Israeli regime? Obviously, they're not doing something right there.
Well, you're right. This is reported in the Zionist media also that they the U.S. intelligence group said that they're not going to be able to get rid of Hamas because really Hamas is just the tip of the Palestinian resistance iceberg, and that's not going to go away anytime soon, basically. But when you're talking about Al-Shifa, remember also this is a hospital that was devastated before. It's in the north in Gaza City. There are still civilians there, even though conditions of life have been very difficult in the areas. All of the residential areas being devastated around there. There also is resistance there. The resistance is back in areas where the Israelis thought they'd got rid of them. So the civilians are there. And really, of course, this idea that they're actually going after Hamas is only part of the story. Anyway, let's remember that they have said many times to us, you know, and this is what the South Africans have carried to the International Court of Justice. They want to destroy the conditions of life to make it unbearable. They want to destroy the people or drive them out. And of course, this new port that the US is involved in is widely suspected now of being a way to try and evacuate and take Palestinians out of Gaza to help with the ethnic cleansing of the area. So the assault on civilians has always been a openly stated part of this genocide. Very few genocides in the past have openly stated as clearly as the Israelis have this one. So this new attack on Al-Shifa tells us, well, there are still civilians there. There is still resistance there. The Israelis are back there. They're trying to make conditions of life unbearable for the people there because they have these dreams of turning it into a car park or some new tourist resort after they've got rid of the inconvenient fact of the fact that people still live there.
Thank you so much. Farhi's journalist, author, and activist. And thank you, Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. With that, we come to an end for this news review.
The appointment of a new Palestinian prime minister and planned formation of a new Palestinian government have sparked internal disputes and division. A senior Palestinian official has told Press TV that some factions have called for a national consensus and a unified Palestinian leadership before the formation of a government. Mona Candir brings us more.
The appointment of a new Palestinian prime minister at the current circumstances could deepen divisions as the Israeli war on Gaza rages. This is what some Palestinian factions revealed after President Mahmoud Abbas appointed Mohammed Mustafa, a long-trusted advisor on economic affairs, as prime minister and tasked him with forming a new government. Both Hamas and resistance movements, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the Palestinian National Initiative, said that without national consensus, it's a reinforcement of a policy of exclusion and the deepening of division. We met Dr. Mustafa Al-Barghouti, Secretary General of the National Initiative. He told us that the most important thing is now a unified leadership. Mohammed Mustafa replaces Mohammed Shtayyi, who resigned less than 3 weeks ago, citing the need for real change. Experts, however, say there had been mounting pressure on Abbas to reform the Palestinian Authority and initiate the establishment of a political framework capable of governing a future Palestinian state to take charge of all Palestinian territories after the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza ends.
First of all, that there was a pressure on Palestinian Authority to make some changes, and that's why they complied immediately and appointing Mohammed Mustafa as the new prime minister. This is on the one hand. On the other hand, which is most importantly as well, what the Palestinians wanted. The Palestinians don't want another government to be the same. The problem here is with Israel. Are they, and the international community, are they able to really make the change and let this government to work or not?
The new prime minister now would work to form a technocratic government of experts. Abbas has also asked Mustafa to create plans to reunite the administration of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, reform the government, and address internal corruption. A real political change, not a change in words only, is what the people here desire. Moreover, the upcoming government faces numerous challenges, namely rebuilding the Gaza Strip, torpedoing Israeli plans to control the coastal enclave, and managing Palestinians' lives. Mona Kandil, Occupy, Ramallah.
The EU foreign policy chief says Israel's genocide in Gaza has turned the territory into the world's biggest open-air graveyard.
The situation in Gaza. Gaza was before the war the greatest open-air prison. Today is the greatest open-air graveyard. A graveyard for tens of thousands of people, and also a graveyard for many of the most important principles of humanitarian law.
Borrell was speaking ahead of an EU foreign ministerial meeting in Brussels. He reiterated that Israel is using famine as a weapon of war by not allowing aid trucks into Gaza. Borrell said the issue is not a lack of sufficient supplies for Gaza. It's rather Israel deliberately preventing them from entering the besieged strip. According to the World Food Program, 70% of the remaining people in northern Gaza are at catastrophic levels of hunger.
We need sufficient amounts of food to get into northern Gaza and to be able to be distributed to the people who are in need over there. Mind you, there are 300,000 people in that location right now, of which 70%, meaning 210,000 people, are in catastrophic level of hunger. The remaining 30%, they are in emergency levels of hunger.
A UN-backed food security assessment report also indicates that around half the population of Gaza is experiencing catastrophic hunger due to the Israeli onslaught. The report warns that famine is imminent in the war-torn territory unless urgent intervention is made. The Russian president has issued a stern warning to the West over sending military troops in support of Ukraine. Vladimir Putin says a direct confrontation between Russia and NATO will push the world to the brink of a full-scale World War III.
I think that anything is possible in the modern world, but I've already said this, and it is clear to everyone that this conflict between Russia and NATO will be just one step away from a full-scale World War III. I don't think anybody is interested in this. NATO military are present there in Ukraine. There's nothing good in this. Firstly for them, because they get killed in large numbers.
Putin made the remarks in a presser shortly after securing another six-year term in office in the biggest landslide victory in post-Soviet Russian history. Well, the warning came in response to an earlier statement by French President Emmanuel Macron, who highlighted the necessity of Western ground operations in Ukraine at some point. Commenting on the prospects of peace talks with Kiev, Putin said Moscow remains open to negotiations, but won't be lured into a truce that would allow Ukraine to rearm. He added that Russian armed forces hold the initiative on the battlefield as they have made advances in Ukraine. Fred Weir, political commentator too in Moscow, believes that Putin's repeated calls to discuss an end to the Ukraine war should be taken seriously.
It would be a massive escalation. NATO troops in Ukraine would start getting killed, and we would be on the threshold of World War III, wouldn't we? I think that the fact that it's being discussed in Europe, it's not a serious discussion yet. President Macron brought it up, but it seems like it's been put on the table, and that would change the whole nature of the war. I think that's what Putin was saying, because if NATO troops came into Ukraine, they would be face-to-face with Russian troops, and the killing would start. I don't know a better definition of World War III than that. Macron wants a ceasefire for the duration of the Paris Olympics in September. I don't think the Russians are going to go for that, especially since Russians aren't welcome to participate in those Olympics. So Putin has repeatedly said, and I suppose he should be taken seriously, that Russia is ready to talk about the war in Ukraine, about ending it, but on Russian terms. And so far, that's unacceptable in Kiev and apparently in the West as well.
Well, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has launched multiple short-range ballistic missiles aimed amid growing tensions on the Korean Peninsula. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff detected the launches early on Monday. It says the missiles flew around 300 kilometers before going down in the waters east of the Korean Peninsula. And the new development comes as the U.S. Secretary of State is in South Korea for talks. Washington and Seoul wrapped up their latest joint war games last week. Pyongyang considers such drill rehearsals for an invasion. Our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, says that many people around the globe miss the real news on the Korean Peninsula due to the lack of access to objective media.
There are other exercises that are taking place in just a few days this week that the press has been invited to, for South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, who restarted these war games and strengthened the alliance with the U.S., brought in more so-called strategic assets. These are U.S. weapons capable of delivering a nuclear strike against North Korea. It's hard to really argue with North Korea's analysis of this when some of these drills involve bridge crossings and amphibious landings and simulated decapitation strikes aimed at North Korean leadership. It's hard to argue that these are really provocative in nature, and that North Korea is responding to these drills rather than the U.S. and South Korea spin of this, that it's the U.S. that it's North Korea that's fomenting conflict, that's fomenting an arms race in the region, with again, South Korea increasing its import of U.S. arms, including 20 more Joint Strike F-35 fighter jets that they just ordered. So, again, it's how this is being spun, really, for an international community that sometimes is missing the mark, not really, you know, having access to more objective media, I believe.
And with that, brings us to the end of this Worldless edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
On June 18, 1994, when Francisco Oscar Lamolina, the referee of the opening game of the World Cup, blew into the whistle, over 77,000 spectators were shouting in jeers at Pontiac Silverdome Stadium in Detroit. It was the first time that the World Cup was being held in the U.S. For a month, all eyes all over the world were fixated at the event. The shining stars of the world of football, like Romario, Roberto Baggio, Hristo Stoichkov, and Gheorghe Hagi, filled the stadiums to the brim. With every goal, yellow or red cards, the stadiums were in uproar, like the day when Nigeria thrashed Bulgaria with 3 goals and the fans of the team were madly shouting out of joy. People who had traveled thousands of miles from Africa so they could watch the games up close. Those days were good days for the people in Africa, but not for all the residents of the continent. Right at the time when people across the world were glued to their television sets to watch Nigeria's exhilarating display of skills, in a part of Africa, one of the most brutal genocide in the history of mankind was underway. Apparently, Rachel Carson is the biggest murderer in history, and yet nobody was aware for a long time. Everyone admired Carson for being a nice human being and a great author, and also for her role as an environmental activist. She has been praised in numerous books, articles, and reports, but in the end, the mask was removed from her face. They said that the woman who had a charming smile on her face in all of the pictures and the only thing she cared about was nature was behind the death of millions of people in Africa. The deaths happened after she genetically modified mosquitoes. If we take a look at history, we'll find out that Rachel Carson's life in many ways had striking similarity with major criminals throughout history, like Hitler, who used to paint pictures when he was a young man, or Stalin, who was a choir singer. Carson was into art, literature, and poetry. She was born in Pennsylvania and graduated from Johns Hopkins University in 1932. After getting a degree in zoology, she started her career as a journalist. 15 years later, she displayed so much talent and skills in the field of aquatic creatures that she supervised all publications in this field. During those years, she tried books besides working as a journalist. Her books are on environment and the seas, which gained Carson fame. She resigned from all of her posts in 1952 so she could concentrate mainly on writing books. The most important book she wrote in that period was her autobiography. The US media, as well as many chemists and physicians, say the book changed the fate of millions of people in African and many other parts of the world. Carson's name turned into the nightmare of people who were grappling with malaria.
In Africa and Asia, the mosquito is a mass killer. More than 2 million people die every year from malaria, which mosquitoes transmit.
Based on figures and documents proposed by Dr. Gordon Edwards, an entomologist at the University of San Jose in California, stated in his paper that the elimination of DDT helped the mosquitoes that transit malaria to reproduce without any barriers. In a few years, the population of the mosquitoes grew so large that millions of Africans fell victim to the disease and lost their lives, according to Edwards in an article titled Bias, Misinformation, Half-Truth, published in 1992 in the Science and Technology magazine. The Silent Spring has been one of the deadliest books in history as it sent millions of people in Africa to their death. Some people put the number of fatalities at about 50 million people, larger than the number of the casualties in the Second World War. The documents leaked in the 1980s and 1990s by some tobacco company staff revealed that the owners of the companies had known as an established fact from the 1950s that smoking can cause cancer. In one of these documents dated 1953, Claude Tigo, one of the scientific advisors of Camel Tobacco Company, wrote to his director that the tobacco in cigarettes is one of the main factors behind lung cancer, and added that there is a direct correlation between smoking and lung cancer. A decade before that, Emma Harris Palmer, the head of the research center of Lord Yard, acknowledged that there is ample evidence to prove the link between smoking and lung cancer.
The company is Brown & Williamson, America's third largest tobacco company. The man they've set out to destroy is Dr. Jeffrey Wigand, their former $300,000-a-year director of research.
In 1996, another revelation was made on CBS's 60 Minutes program. Jeffrey Wigand, one of the personnel of the Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company, leaked significant information about the tobacco industry. Michael Mann made a movie out of the developments named The Insider, starring Russell Crowe, who played the role of Jeffrey Wigand. The movie received accolade by film critics.
Catch you in a lie. They can paint everything with that brush. You understand?
Everything you say.
I told the truth.
Everything you say.
And I can't defend you, man, with one hand tied behind my back because you keep from me what they can discover.
And they will discover everything. Believe me.
I was young.
There are many documents like that. Yet, when the scientists were summoned to the U.S. Congress to testify about the addictive aspect of nicotine, they all testified that the substance is not addictive. Later, it was revealed that most of them were on the payroll of the tobacco companies. As U.S. poet and writer Upton Bill Sinclair said almost a century ago, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it." The owners of the tobacco companies understood the meaning of this sentence very well. In today's world, money decides what people should know, and what they shouldn't. Even worse, it is the big companies that decide to show a distorted image of the reality to the people, and they are ready to get the scientists on board to achieve their goals. For years, scientists and environmental activists have warned of the impact of fossil fuels on climate change. Ordinary people try to meet their end of the bargain and make the earth less polluted. On the other hand, a major company like ExxonMobil releases 320 scientific papers every year to argue that the company's oil activities and fossil fuel do not have much effect on climate change. In recent years, the company has hired thousands of scientists and has spent huge amounts of money to get its messages across the scientific events and undermine conflicting scientific findings to eventually reach its objective, creating fear among people. Nothing as much as doubt can mislead the audience in their decision-making. But this isn't all ExxonMobil does to create doubt among people. In 2016, they spent $9 million for their lawyers and lobbies in Washington to fail the climate change bill. The figure was $29 million in 2008. After 8 years, the senators and representatives have grown soft spots, and it seems it takes less to convince them. These measures have made many people in the U.S. believe that ExxonMobil is an advocate of science. However, the scientific works in favor of ExxonMobil as it helps the company extract and sell more oil. Yet, in order to find out how major companies like ExxonMobil take science hostage to serve their own objectives, we can highlight one more case, the James Hansen case.
I'm James Hansen. I'm the head of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and it's H-A-N-S-E-N.
In 1988, James Hansen, a NASA scientist who had studied environmental issues and the effects of CO2 on the Earth for years, mentioned a phenomenon called global warming. He took part in a Congress session and raised the alarm over the phenomenon for mankind that can wipe off life from the face of the Earth. Hansen was now known as the father of global warming. His statements quickly spread in major international media. George Bush Sr. took advantage of the issue for his election campaign and talked about his administration's determination to put a bridle on global warming, but added, "The issue still needs further study." After a while, the scientific advisors at the White House entered the scene in a collaboration with the industry lobbyists in the U.S. and raised doubts about the claims made by Hansen. They and many other scientists argued that global warming has always existed and that the issue has happened during the Renaissance and sought to pretend the issue as a natural phenomenon. The issue did not stop by providing scientific reasons. They said the claim can lead to a reduction in production and can put brakes on U.S. Congress, and warned this is exactly what the communists and socialists want. Hence, Hansen was accused of advocating communism. However, after several years, it has come to light that many of the figures who lectured people on television networks against global warming had no expertise in this field and had been picked by the companies to oppose Hansen and his arguments. What's more, some of the people who were picked in debates on global warming were so frail that could not properly defend the issue.
Last Week Tonight presents a statistically representative climate change debate.
Good evening. Joining me tonight, a climate change denier and naturally Bill Nye Science Guy.
Humans are causing climate change, no question.
Wait. Before we begin, in the interest of mathematical balance, I'm going to bring out two people who agree with you, climate skeptic. And Bill Nye, I'm also going to bring out 96 other scientists. It's a little unwieldy, but this is the only way you can actually have a representative discussion. Please file in. Again, this is going to make the debate difficult. We shouldn't really be having it in the first place.
It was back then when global warming was labeled as a theory to further question its validity. In fact, the global warming issue was important for factory owners and governments more than anyone else. Because if everyone believed in it, and in case the regulations on CO2 were to be tightened, they would have been deep in trouble. So the companies, the media, and scientists affiliated with them resorted to strange tactics. For example, when global warming alarmists published a magazine, the opponents also published a similar magazine in the same size and color and even the number of pages to mislead Congress members. The interesting point was the magazine was signed by over 31,000 American scientists. The media stressed on the number time and time again.
Look, 31,000 scientists and engineers signed a statement to the contrary to what you just read.
The Oregon petition?
Yes.
More than 31,000 scientists.
More than 31,000 scientists.
And more than 31,000 American scientists rejecting global warming alarmism.
Political pressure forced NASA in 2004 to commit to the White House that it won't publish Hansen's studies without prior approval. What's more, the data on global warming were removed from public access. Hansen was also warned that he could not take part in regular interviews by NPR. They even manipulated the results of studies by Hansen. So he had to go to Congress once again and sit face to face with Al Gore, one of proponents of Hansen's theory. Al Gore continues to run a foundation to fight global warming. During the session, he asked Hansen to elaborate on parts of his report. But Hansen said those parts of the report were not his statements and they had been altered. In fact, a person named Philip Conney, who used to work in an oil company, was put in charge of the Bush administration's environmental policies. He received a report from the United States Environmental Protection Agency that had warned of the global warming. Conney had no knowledge on the issue. He edited the report and removed a paragraph and instead wrote, "These are just claims and speculations." Al Gore shed light on the incident in 2005, which was a scandal for the White House. Philip Conney had to resign a few days later under pressure. But the day after his resignation, Conney was recruited in the ExxonMobil oil company. That was exactly the time when Hansen was ridiculed and repelled by the media. Conney accomplished his mission. Because of the efforts by him and his colleagues to confuse people on global warming, today, almost half of the people in the U.S. do not believe the issue. Besides the ordinary people, some top politicians in the world also think that global warming is a big joke.
So Obama's talking about all of this with the global warming and that. And a lot of it's a hoax. It's a hoax. I mean, it's a money-making industry, okay? It's a hoax.
Donald Trump was the vanguard of the doubters. Just days into his presidency, he posted a tweet writing, It's snowing and freezing in New York City. What the hell ever happened to global warming? He had better taken a trip to Greenland and the disappeared ice sheets before openly doubting the global warming. His remarks were in line with the flurry of doubts that the owners of major companies have been planting in people's minds for many years, so the industry giants keep going. Their survival depends on not understanding.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another special edition of the program The Ocean of Dua. In this special edition during the holy month of Ramadan, we will be having a look at different parts of the supplication Abu Hamza Sumali. We will be bringing you different commentaries on some parts of this dua. We'll be back after you listen to these parts.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ilahi
لو قرنتني بالأصفاد ومنعتني سيبك من بين الأشهاد ودللت على فضائحي عيون العباد وأمرت بي إلى النار وحلت بيني وبين الأبرار ما قطعت رجائي منك وما صرفت تأميلي للعفو عنك ولا خرج حبك من قلبي أنا لا أنسى أياديك عندي وسترك علي في دار الدنيا.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing this part of the supplication of Abu Hamza Thumali. إلهي لو قرنتني بالأصفاد ومنعتني سيبك من بين الأشهاد ودللت على فضائح عيون العباد وأمرت بي إلى النار وحلت بيني وبين الأبرار ما قطعت رجائي منك. O Allah, if I had been yoked to and tied with chains, if I were cut off from the flowing stream of your bounties, and I was in the presence of the witnessing people that were all eyes to see how I was exposed to infamy and disgrace, even if I was ordered to proceed to hell, and even if there was a barrier put between me and the pious ones, even then, ما قطعت رجائي منك, I would not cease to have hope. وما صرفت تأميلي للعفو عنك, I would not stop from expecting your pardon. لا خرج حبك من قلبي. O Allah, this, all these things would not take away your love from my heart. أنا لا أنسى أياديك عندي. I have not forgotten the bounties. وسترك علي في دار الدنيا. I have not forgotten your concealment and protection that you made available for me in this world. Regarding this part of the supplication of Abu Hamza, we said that Imam alayhi salam is teaching us two practical ways of nurturing the love of God. First, to pay attention to the blessings of the Almighty Allah. أَنَا لَا أَنْسَى أَيَادِيَكَ عِنْدِي was mentioned right after the part where Imam says لَا خَرَجَ حُبُّكَ مِنْ قَلْبِي. So it seems this phrase is acting as a phrase teaching us the reason. How should we nurture this love of God? Why doesn't this love of God exit the heart of such a servant? Because أَنَا لَا أَنْسَى أَيَادِيَكَ عِنْدِي, I would not forget your bounties. And then, وَسِتْرَكَ عَلَيَّ فِي دَارِ الدُّنْيَا. This is the second reason. Paying attention to God's concealment of our sins. Concerning the sins we commit in private, God has provided the ground for other people not to become aware of them. This is the thing we mostly neglect. This is also one of the great blessings that God has given man. Sometimes, when man is alone, he commits a wicked act, but God the Exalted conceals the sin from public view. Had it not been for this blessing, that man could not afford to be present in public. And for this reason, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says, أَنَا لَا أَنْسَى أَيَادِيَكَ عِنْدِي. O Allah, I do not forget your helping hand upon me. I do not forget your protection, your concealment. وَسِتْرَكَ عَلَيَّ فِي دَارِ الدُّنْيَا. I had so many secrets in this life, in life of this world, but you were the one who held my hand. You were the one who concealed my sins and my secrets from the people.
Ramadan, Ramadan.
The ocean of dua.
So, when Imam says, أَنَا لَا أَنْسَى أَيَادِيَكَ عِنْدِي وَسِتْرَكَ عَلَيَّ فِي دَارِ الدُّنْيَا, we have to reflect upon ourselves. If during the holy month of Ramadan, we do not prepare ourselves for a program such as this program, that we must try to remember, we must try to remind ourselves the mercy, the bounties and blessings of the Almighty Allah. If we do not prepare ourselves, we will not find any time more suitable than this. If we do not benefit from these opportunities, the opportunity of sacred month of Ramadan, a time will come when we will regret, when we will be at loss. So there suddenly will come a time that we will come to our senses. We will realize that another month of Ramadan has passed, but we have not repented for our sins. We are not relieved of those afflictions we got ourselves into. But by paying attention to the blessings of the Almighty Allah, by paying attention to sitraka alayya fi dar ad-dunya, to the protection of the secrets, to the concealment of our sins in this world, we will be stepping up towards this journey of our program, our self-perfection during the month of Ramadan. If we do not fulfill the rights of people, if we do not stop backbiting and lying, and other things we commit daily, we will regret the time we have missed this opportunity of the Almighty Allah. Because Imam says, أَفَبِلِسَانِي هَذَا الْكَالِ أَشْكُرُكَ أَمْ بِغَايَةِ جُهْدِي فِي عَمَلِي أُرْضِيكَ, can I, with this heavy tongue of mine, thank you, or with my utmost effort satisfy you? وَمَا قَدْرُ لِسَانِي يَا رَبِّي فِي جَنْبِ شُكْرِكَ وَمَا قَدْرُ عَمَلِي فِي جَنْبِ نِعْمِكَ وَإِحْسَانِكَ, what is the value of my good deeds compared to your gifts and patience with me? Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us. We are done with this part of supplication of Abu Hamza al-Thumali, and we will move on to another part in the next episode, God willing. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir. www.arabienglish.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.